All right. Welcome to the Nth Screen podcast. We're your hosts. I'm George Murray.
And I'm Ben Tomasetti.
This is the episode for January
31st. 2011.
Our fifth podcast.
Number five. Right.
All right.
We're almost at a half dozen.
It's awesome. This week, what are we going to talk about, Ben?
This week, we thought we'd look at the Tunisian and Egyptian revolutions that are happening right now, and we know they're really big stories, and you know, our podcast is not about politics, it's about technology,
but they're doing some really cool stuff with technology, and we thought we would like to cover that. And we're also gonna give a little primer on what these two protests are about, and you know, just what's going on. So
exactly, so we're gonna talk about the really big picture changes that are happening in Tunisia and Egypt right now, and then talk about the very small component of those stories that we happen to nerd out on. That's going to be today's podcast.
Our loving technology.
Right, exactly.
All right, cue the music. All right, so that was some music from this new video game I'm playing called Super Meat Boy. It's pretty fun. It's a platformer, and it's very, like, fast-paced. It's like Super Mario Brothers, but much harder.
Much quicker.
Much faster, yeah.
Yeah. Way easier to die.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are we going to talk about today?
So today, before we get into the piece of tech news that came out of Tunisia, I just want to give some background on what's actually happening over there, because it's a pretty big deal. The people of Tunisia have been under a dictatorship since they gained independence from France in 1956. The most recent was a guy named Ben Ali, who's been the dictator since 1987, so going on 24 years almost. For you who don't know where it is, it's east of Libya, so they're on the north coast of Africa, and west of Algeria, so basically due south of France. The interesting thing about Tunisia is they have a very highly educated population. A large percentage of their populace gets college degrees, but they also have a very high unemployment rate. Right now it's hovering about 13%. So the sort of claimed impetus for the revolution was there's a 26-year-old named Mohamed Bouazizi. He lived in Tunisia. He had a bachelor's in engineering. He lived in Tunisia. He couldn't find a job anywhere. So he decided he was going to sell fruit on the street just to raise some money, help support his family. But his cart got seized by the police because he didn't have a permit, which he had applied for, and they wouldn't give him. You know, here he is. He's out of options. He has a degree. He can't find a job in engineering. He tries some service sector job. They forcibly shut him down. So he decided his best option was to set himself on fire in front of the parliament building. So he did. And right after he set himself on fire, it seems like the rest of Tunisian society was like, my word, it is really that bad, isn't it? And something just snapped in their collective consciousness, and they took to the streets. So it was building for a while, and then unfortunately Mohammed died around mid-January, and that's when it really just went crazy over there. Ben Ali eventually fled on the 14th of January to Saudi Arabia.
The dictator,
with what we just read was 1.5 tons of gold that he looted from the treasury, and now he's being hunted down. Or searched for, maybe we should say, by Interpol, the interstate police operation. So that was the Jasmine Revolution. It took about 4 or 5 weeks.
It was called the Jasmine?
It was called the Jasmine Revolution after the flower, which I guess is prevalent in Tunisia. And now, you know, they have a caretaker government. They're going to have new elections. And what I read was 45 to 60 days.
So how long did that take? It was like the beginning of January or the month of January?
So it was pretty much like mid-December to mid-January was the slow build-up, and then there was the crescendo, and the dictator just, he just got out.
Okay.
So we keep saying dictator. He was quote-unquote democratically elected many times with 80-plus percent of the vote, which I was telling George earlier, you can't get 80-plus percent of the people to agree if it's a good idea to wear shoes with laces or loafers, right? Like, you can't get 80-plus percent of the people to agree on if they should drink water that day. You know? Like, yeah. You just can't. It's not possible.
Okay, so votes just don't happen like that?
I don't think so. I don't think so. Not in, like, a large, well-educated country. I don't think you're going to get 80-plus percent of the people to feel the same way about any issue.
All right.
Yeah.
So
that's the background.
Okay. And so what was Tunisia doing? I've heard that they've always been really censored. It's a country that's always been, like, extremely censored. Tell me about the technology part of this.
Okay, so the story goes, Tunisia is about the size of Michigan, and...
Is it shaped like a hand?
No. No. I guess if it's shaped like anything, it's sort of shaped like New Jersey a little bit. It kind of looks like New Jersey. So Tunisia is about the size of Michigan, but I was reading an article in The Atlantic that said that... around the beginning, mid-December, so right after Mohammed set himself on fire, Tunisian activity on Facebook just started spiking. They were getting tens, dozens, hundreds of thousands of people a day signing up for Facebook to connect with each other. And
Signing up. Wow.
And then, you know, maintaining, logging in, maintaining a presence on the site.
So it wasn't a bunch of people who already had Facebook, like dormant Facebook accounts, who were just like...
I'm sure there was some of that.
But most of it was like people signing up.
A large percentage was new registrations.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, well, that's really weird because this country has, you know, 20 million people or less, and we're getting 1% of their country logging in a day or signing up a day. Like, that's... pretty unusual.
Mm-hmm. Facebook was...
Yeah, Facebook was thinking that.
Okay.
And then, you know, they started mining the data a little bit, and after about a week, they realized that, you know, a lot of it was legitimate traffic, but a lot of the traffic they were also seeing was coming from a script attack that the government, because they had a single ISP, that the government was using to basically mine Facebook username and passwords. As the Tunisians are like, you know, they've discovered a new tool. They think it's great. They're using it. They're coordinating. They're spreading information, you know. And as they're figuring that out, the government is figuring out, well, hey, if we can hack all of these people's sites at the same time, maybe we can use that knowledge to disrupt their activities or shut them down or find out who they are, because Facebook, unlike a lot of other services, requires you to use your actual name instead of an alias. So you have thousands of people that the government particularly is intrigued with and wants to find out who they are on a service that's being hacked.
So a little backstory on this. Prior to the Tunisian protests, Facebook had already come under fire. I think it was in October at a hacker conference called TorCon. A hacker revealed this problem with Facebook, you know, that he was able to scrape passwords from people who were logging into Facebook and get their identities. So he made a Firefox plugin to do exactly this. It's called FireSheep, and it does exactly what the Tunisian government was doing to its
citizens.
Yeah, but this hacker at this hacking conference brought it up as like a kind of a, and he made this tool called Fire Sheep that that really like made it straightforward, you know, the severity of this issue.
It's you know, he built a one-click hacking tool so that anyone can go to a coffee shop or the single ISP of their country and run this tool,
yeah,
and find out everyone in the coffee shop's Facebook ID and login.
Yep.
Or anyone in the country, for instance. So it's just interesting to us that, you know, the government decided to use this exploit against Facebook to track down their citizens. We don't have any reports of people actually being arrested or something based on their user data. And to Facebook's credit, they built a country-specific patch that requires them to log in through secure HTTP. So if you see the S after the P in your browser bar,
yeah,
you know, it's a secure site. You see that on your bank or when you're buying something.
Get the little, the lock.
Exactly,
icon,
yeah.
So, and then they also just rolled this out as an option to everyone. So now Facebook, under your account settings and security settings, you can opt into encrypted login, which is, you know, it's like, thank goodness we're not like, you know, having our government use it against us yet.
Yeah.
You know, like the Tunisian people.
Yeah. Were, you know. But if you've used it at a coffee shop, they might have already,
someone may
have already gotten it. So change your password.
Yeah, it was probably Ben, actually.
It was definitely not me.
Yeah.
So that's like the one piece of the story that we thought was really cool and nerdy.
So then a week after the Tunisian protests and I guess you could call it revolution, then Egypt has its own protest starting on January 25th. So Egypt has always been under something called emergency law. It was enacted in 1967, and it's been turned on and off throughout the years, but it's definitely on now. They're using the emergency law as method for protecting the country Egypt against terrorism, but in exchange for that protection, civilians have limited constitutional rights. Censorship is allowed, and there's a higher level of police forces. Like, you can be detained indefinitely without any reason. Just general, like, state control, you know? And so all of this kind of came... Oh, and on top of that, there's President Mubarak, who has done a... He's pulled a Tunisian...
Ben Ali.
Yeah, he's pulled a Tunisian Ben Ali, and basically they haven't had really honest democratic elections for the last...
he's been in power 30 years.
30 years?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, again, he always wins with, you know, 90% of the vote. Yeah.
So, starting on January 25th... they've had daily protests. And one of the tools that they've used have been Twitter and Facebook. However, since Egypt is such a... has all of these state control kind of infrastructure in place, the Egyptian government chose to shut down the internet in Egypt. They literally turned off the internet, and they also turned off all mobile phone service. So just imagine for a second what that would be like in the United States.
Yeah.
It would be, I mean...
Everything would grind to a halt.
No Angry Birds.
Well, you could still
play
that.
Yeah,
you don't
need... Right.
But...
No more Farmville.
Well, there would be no stock market, right? a lot of businesses wouldn't be able to operate because their inventory and cash systems are on the net.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. You can text anyone. You can call your mother and let her know you're okay. You can't send her an email. There's no communications. So cell service is on, I think, or maybe it's just landline service. There is some voice connections coming out of the country. But yeah, the internet's off. Today is actually Monday. We heard today that the last ISP has been ordered to shut down. They were on through the weekend. They had five main ones, and they shut down four, and they left one up. And the last one today was ordered to shut down.
Yeah. So the way that Egyptians have been getting around this is awesome.
There's been a lot of
doing some
crazy innovations happening coming out of Egypt right now.
Yeah, it's very kind of hacking things together and making things work from paper flyers, just like brute force, you know, photocopies and a very specific instructions to like
the type of clothes you should wear to protect yourself from tear gas.
Yeah.
Specific attack methods if you were going to, say, spray paint a police officer in the face, which is, seriously, I've seen that one. I think those are the two that stick out the most. But yeah, there's one that's like describes the recommended attire for keeping yourself safe.
Then there's like fax machines, and we saw people were using the website, or people are using the web a lot like it was used in the early 90s that I remember, where like it was a lot about like sharing how to hack things together. You know, it was like, hey, did you know if you run this program on your phone and then Bluetooth into it, you can get on the internet, or you know, just stuff like that. It kind of takes me back.
What George is talking about is that we read a how-to specifically aimed at Egypt, describing how to turn your mobile phone, if you still have coverage, into a modem, dial-up modem, to get your computer on the internet. And basically, you share the data connection via Bluetooth from your phone to your computer.
Very clever.
And you're dialing into, you know, ISPs around the world. They had a whole list of usernames and passwords that ISPs in France
and
Spain and Italy have been setting up for these people to call into and get online.
Yeah, and this is just an example of why people need to understand their technology, because when, you know, when you lose it,
when someone turns it off,
when someone tries to turn it off. Back on. And it's increasingly important. So anyways, in addition to this...
Yeah, the other really cool story.
The really cool story is that Twitter and Google got together.
Also today. This happened today.
Just today? Yeah. Monday?
Yeah.
Monday, January 31st, when we're recording this.
Right.
They got together and they set up a website or a telephone number now that Egyptians can call into... and tweet what they say. So
Google and Twitter have set up a couple dedicated international numbers, and Egyptians can call in and leave voice messages using SayNow's technology that are then automatically tweeted. A link to them is tweeted to Twitter, and if the username that they're being posted to is speak2tweet, that's the word speak, the numeral two, and then the word tweet. So you can go there and you can listen. George and I have listened to a couple of them today. The vast majority are in Arabic, so we obviously don't understand, but it's, at 9 p.m. Pacific, there have been over 230 of these called in. And we did find one in English. And we thought we'd just play it for you, give you a little bit of what's happening over there and what how people are feeling.
I need to be free man and a better life for my kids. Please help us all the world.
Wow.
So
it always sends me chills. And I've probably listened to that like a dozen times now.
Yeah, and that's...
I mean, we wouldn't have heard that man except for this service, which I think is interesting and neat, and it's...
And that's only possible because of this technology. Like, that guy would have said something like that, you know, I'm sure, like, there are tons of people who are feeling that, you know?
Yeah.
But he was able to get it to us. I mean, how long did we spend on... You know, trying to find in English.
We listened to about 20.
And about
we
found, 20. We found, this was the first one that we found in English. Yeah. And, yeah, so out of 200 and what, 80?
It was 235 last I checked.
Yeah. So that's just wild.
Yeah.
You know?
And we'll link to this from the blog. If you guys want to go hear it yourself, we'll send a link to their hashtag too, or their username, I mean. So it's just interesting that when, you know, people have this need to connect, and when it's taken away, but they, especially now when the Egyptians and the Tunisians feel like they have a story to tell, you know, it's gonna find a way back
to get
out. It's gonna find a way to get out, and I just feel privileged that it found its way to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that. When people get a taste of technology and of communication, I think that when people get a taste of communication freedom, like they get from Twitter or whatever the current like technology du jour is, like that, you can't replace that. And when it gets taken away, everyone obviously wants to get it back. It's like you can't take away, you can't give someone some freedom and then like take it away, you know, like someone who gets a taste of communication freedom like will find a way to get it, you know.
I agree, kind of. I don't think it matters the technological platform, which is what we're seeing, right? It doesn't matter that their internet's down. Like, people are calling their friends in other countries and having them write blog posts or something. But it's really about the amplification effect of networked communication. So it's not so much that they want a particular technology du jour, but it's more so that they want the amplification. They want to be heard, and they want to be heard right now.
Yeah.
And that they're going to find a way to do that.
Right. So I think this is what I'm getting at, is that the amplification is the technology.
You mean the network?
Yeah.
The internet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't matter which corporation brings you the tool, which George knows I have a huge problem with things being called the Twitter revolution or the Facebook revolution.
But I haven't heard anyone call it like Twitter revolution.
Well, they did like, with Iran. And then with the Facebook involvement in Tunisia, they kind of call it the Facebook revolution, which I think it's just, you know, media shorthand for an easier narrative oftentimes. I think it oversimplifies the situation, and it sort of elevates the presence of some, you know, an obviously important but just a corporation over the struggles of these people and them trying to find the path that they think is right for them and their country.
Yeah. Like you were bringing up that South American revolution that happened.
Yeah, so the Mexican Revolution in like 1910, 1920, between 1910 and 1920, the world found out about it because of, you know, analog photography was very big then. And a lot of people died, but they only found out about it because of the work of a lot of Mexican journalists taking pictures and sneaking them out of the country. But you know, we don't call it the Leica Revolution. We don't call it the Polaroid Revolution, right? It's the Mexican Revolution.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But photography is still part of that story.
I agree. Photography is part of that story. And I think photography is part of this story, too, right? It's just the dissemination method is now digitizing and networking.
Yeah. I think that why we're focused so much on the technology right now is just because we're so much more media just cognizant of the channels that we use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, like, and the value of those channels, like, I really want to separate the fact that, like, the companies that bring that this technology, that these amplification methods, like,
yeah,
it's easy to, like, attach their brand to it, but really what it's about is the amplification that the technology brings, and it seems like some of these things wouldn't be possible without those amplifications. Or,
well, it's also, yeah, and shorthand, right? Like, a photograph is a shorthand for being there and experiencing something in real life.
Yeah.
And I would say that a tweet is a shorthand too. You know, it's not a conversation, it's not even an IM chat, right? It's just a short burst, but it gives you a sense of what it's like.
It's like this message that we just listened to.
Right. Yeah. It's and they, you know, that was, I feel like that was very powerful. And they can be very powerful. And the biggest thing for me has been the videos that have leaked out of these protests, seeing people praying in the streets and being shot with water or throwing tear gas back at the police officers that threw it at them. And I just can't even fathom what it would be like to be there. Except for this shorthand, this video that's gotten to me, or this photograph. So, you know, I'm thankful for the technologies, but we don't, you know, we don't call it the JPEG revolution, which is the only point that I'm trying to get to.
It's
not the YouTube revolution. It's less the data format or the channel that the message is traveling on, and it's, for me, it's the message that arrives, right?
Yeah.
And it's going to be shaped by whatever tool they've used to get it to you.
Yeah.
But it's the fact that it got to you that's cool.
But there was a YouTube revolution. It just wasn't the Tunisian political thing. It was the realization that we could use these tools. Right? Wasn't it?
I kind of feel like the word revolution has been bastardized. Okay. I feel like a revolution is a very specific thing, which is, you know, right, one social class overthrowing revolution.
But it was like a movement that,
I mean, maybe the YouTube realization.
Realization.
Yeah, I would go along with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, more content is uploaded to YouTube every minute than a human could watch in a whole day, right? So, yeah, video is everywhere, and you're caught on video all the time, and videos of you have been uploaded to the internet often. That sounded creepy. I didn't mean it to be creepy. I just mean we use video to share our experiences with our friends and our family, or in this particular case, you know, with the news media and the world.
Yeah.
So, I think we're about done. You know,
I think this was a different episode.
It was a little deeper and a little current event.
A little less tech. A little less design, I guess.
A little tech. little less tech utopian.
Yeah. Actually, I would say it was utopian. The internet wins always.
If you go into a gunfight, bring the internet.
Yes. It's truly the best weapon.
Okay, so we hope you guys have a wonderful week. Thank you for listening. Catch us on InthScreen. That's nth-screen.com. Or you can find us on iTunes.
And if you have any comments or questions or, you know, suggestions for our next episode, feel free to email them to us or find us on Twitter.